Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Chase Thomas.
All right, hello, and welcome back to a Tuesday edition of John Finkelly Thomas Talks.
See, I hate it. I already hate it.
Baseball, Minnesota Twins 2020 season review edition. John Taylor up there in New York City is here as he is every Tuesday. John, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I am doing quite all right. How about yourself?
It's good. It's good. How was your New Year? Have we talked post-New Year? I don't think so.
I don't think so. Uneventful New Year. I mean, I think everyone hopefully spent it the same way, which is at home.
Well, hold on. No. I was at a rave. Multiple raves.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was raving pretty hard.
Raving hard?
Raving hard, man. Love a good rave in Knoxville, Tennessee, where the stuff is not out of control. But my roommate, one of them, is getting the COVID vaccine today.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Medical students. They're next in line. I don't like hearing, yeah, they were emailing us about, like, they have some extras. So if you want to come in and take it, you can go do it. What a life.
What a system we've got going.
Yeah, like, what is this?
Very good system.
It's a great system. We're all thrilled. Did you do anything interesting? What did you have a good beer on New Year's Eve, John?
No, I made myself a gin and tonic. That's about as far as I went. Didn't want to get too crazy, since, you know, you're just kind of sitting at home. And the thing is, I don't watch the countdown shows. I don't, you know, like the New Year's Eve celebrity, like, you know, we're standing in Times Square and here's some weird musical performances. You know, I mostly was just flipping channels to see what was on, which
that
turns out
sucks.
On New Year's Eve.
Do people really like it? Do people really enjoy watching those shows? Do people really enjoy
it? I can't say that I know. I understand the idea of watching them just because you're, you know, the whole point of New Year's Eve is counting down till midnight, and those shows do that. You know, they remind you, hey, it's almost midnight, and once it is midnight, you can, you know, celebrate with
kiss
us
your
or
lady.
I don't
kiss your man.
Exactly, kiss your partner. But,
yes.
I don't know. I'm sure people do watch them and enjoy them, otherwise they wouldn't make them. But for me, I just never find them interesting because I just the idea of watching people kind of be forced to banter while standing outside in Times Square when it's cold and just while we're all waiting for a clock to reach a certain point in time, like, yeah, it's just a little weird to me. I find New Year's Eve just kind of a blah holiday overall. Especially it's one of those holidays, once you kind of get old enough and you're not, you know, going out to party no more, it's what's really the point?
Yeah, I'm not a big New Year's person either. But yeah. Well, oh, there was one other thing before we get into the news and everything this week. I saw your Instagram story, and I showed the lady friend, and I was like, I think this is going to be nasty. The white Russian in a can. And I was like, I don't think he's going to like this. I think the second part is going to be like, that terrible. Shit's nasty. Yeah.
It was terrible. I do not recommend buying a white Russian in a can. The thing is, I'm sure your listeners are intelligent enough to know that, yeah, a white Russian in a can is not a good idea.
No.
But I figured, why the hell not? Let's give it a try, and it's not worth it. Don't do it. Don't do it.
I literally looked over.
Do not get a white Russian in a can.
Yeah. I literally looked over at her, and I was like, he's going to fucking hate this.
Yeah, and I did. It was not good.
Oh, man. Mistakes were made. It's okay. It's okay, John. I had a bad seltzer. Or no, you know what it was? I got a bad pale ale, because I asked the local pizza shop on the takeout. I was like, what are all... I honestly have no idea what the fuck any of these beers are. And I was like, what is the best one of this group? And they pointed to this one, and I drank it, and it was awful. Like an awful, awful Saturday night beer. I hated every second of it. It was not an enjoyable experience. So we both have had bad alcoholic tastes in the last week. We're one and the same, John.
Good. I'm glad we're in this together.
We're in this together. Don't forget, folks, you can also be in this with us by going to chasethomaspodcast.com, subscribing to the newsletter, sportsrenaissanceman.substack.com that I do every Saturday morning. It's free. Go check that out. Follow John at J.A. Taylor. Follow myself at Chase_Thomas. And leave us a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts if you're an Apple Podcast listener. John, and especially Fisher, would greatly appreciate it. First thing I wanted to hit you with before we get into the Twins, John. The Blue Jays. Reportedly, like, we've talked about them a lot on this podcast this offseason. We've already go back and listen to our preview a few weeks back if you would like to get some more insight into what we think about the Blue Jays' future in 2021. But we were tossing around George Springer. We were tossing around Trevor Bauer. Now we're hearing that the Blue Jays are willing to go $125 million or higher for George Springer. And they have had a secret meeting with Trevor Bauer. But I don't even know if I want to say that out loud because I don't want Trevor Bauer to go at me on Twitter. I don't want to get quote tweeted by Trevor Bauer and the fake reporting that I'm doing by throwing that out there in this podcast. But what do you make of both of these developments?
It makes sense. I mean, I think if there's one thing people have identified with the Blue Jays is that this is kind of a good moment for them to make those kinds of win now moves with Springer, with Bauer, with DJ LeMay, who's another guy they've been tied to a lot. This team, I'm writing up a Blue Jays preview for another place. There's obviously a lot of good young talent and a lot of good young talent also still to come in their farm system. But this is a team that, you know, that they really do have an opportunity here to add some win now players for just money too. And that I think is the most important part because, you know, there are three ways to add talent to your team. You develop it, you draft and develop it, you trade for it, or you sign it. And obviously drafting and developing, you know, that takes time and the Blue Jays are already past that point. Trading for it means you have to sacrifice some of the talent on your team or in your farm system. Signing, all it costs you is money. And the Blue Jays should have plenty of that and a payroll that is both low and should continue to be low going forward because all of these guys right now are operating on the early years of their pre-arb or early arb contracts. You know, Vlad Jr., Bo Bichette, Kevin Biggio, Nate Pearson when he fully gets up. Hyunjin Ryu is really the only guy on that team making any substantial money at this point. So in that sense, it makes a lot of sense for the Blue Jays to use some of that financial – and I know people, that phrase financial flexibility, like, doesn't really mean anything anymore. But that the true meaning of financial flexibility should be using the payroll space you have because of the low salaries you currently are carrying to sign better players to expensive contracts so you don't have to worry about how much they're making.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if George Springer wants $125 million, if Trevor Bauer wants $150 million, whatever it is, you have the room to do that. Because, like I said, the only significant money you're paying out in 2021 is to Hyunjin Ryu. And for some reason, $12 million to Tanner Roark. That's a little weird. But otherwise, it's a lot of guys making very little money. The only guarantees that the Blue Jays have now on the books now, guaranteed money, is $63 million. Throw in arbitration costs and a few other things, you're getting in around the low 80s for next year. That's nothing. They are $100 million shy of the luxury tax threshold. They could sign Bauer, Springer, and LeMahieu and probably not get there in 2021. You know, and yeah, at some point, like, you're going to have to figure out which of these guys do we want to give extensions to early, you know, be it Vlad Jr., be it Bichette, be it Biggio, be it someone else. Fine, but there's plenty of time to figure that out, and the time is also going to make that more obvious for some than others. You know, handing George Springer 20, well, what's 125 divided by 5? It's $23 million a year? Mm-hmm. 25. Handing him $25 million a year is really not going to do a whole lot in terms of keeping you from being able to reward your other players. It's only gonna hurt you if you make it hurt you. You know what I mean? It's only gonna hurt you if you insist that it hurts you. But the Blue Jays can easily afford these kinds of things, and it feels like then if they can, then now is the time to take advantage of it. I don't know if the Blue Jays plus one of Springer, Bauer, or LeMahieu are good enough to win the AL East. I think the Yankees are still better, and the Rays are probably still better too. But it certainly puts them in more in the conversation. It certainly makes them a much better bet to win the wild card or whatever it ends up being if we do or don't get the expanded playoff format next year. So, and not only that, it's not only about 2021. It's about, you know, those guys will be there in 2022 as well. Obviously, the thing you worry about with any of Springer, Bauer, LeMahieu, or anyone else is that, you know, because they're free agents, they're invariably, you know, past 30, which means, you know, they're only going to start declining from this point going forward. But you can kind of offset that because you have all these young guys who are hitting their primes, or theoretically at least, going to be hitting their primes in the next, you know, 2 to 3 years if they're not there already in the case of someone like Biggio. I mean, Vlad Jr. is only 22 years old. There's still a lot of time left for him. So, no, I mean, it makes perfect sense for Toronto, and it's something that, you know, I imagine what they're doing is similar to what the Mets are doing and a couple other teams, is just waiting and hoping that the cost comes down the closer and closer we get to spring training. And also because obviously nobody knows when the season's going to start, what spring training is going to look like. You know, I imagine some teams are probably waiting to get a better sense of what that is before they commit to anything. But either way, no, it makes perfect sense for Toronto. And I think one way or the other, I think they have to come out of this offseason with one of those three guys. Because otherwise, you look at this Blue Jays roster, it's kind of hard to see them as anything more than 500 with the way things currently are.
Which is where they were last year. It also kind of depends on what happens with really like what the Red Sox do. I think the Red Sox, we should still probably at this point pencil in being bad next year. The Orioles are going to be bad next year. And then if the Rays take a step back, which is a distinct possibility. So I think there is an opening, especially if they're turning Blake Snell, that like, hey, if you're the Blue Jays, I wonder if they're looking at that of like, that's it for them. Morton's gone. Snell's gone. They're reloading, and they're going to take a step back next year. And then it's like just the Yankees. And the Yankees are always going to be there. So if that's your hesitancy, if you're Shapiro in this group, then it's fucking crazy. Cause like they're always just going to be there. So if that's your only roadblock to being an 80 plus win team, 90 plus win team this year, I don't know. I think you do it. And I think all these trade, like all these signings would be welcomed by the Blue Jays, and we'd all be like, yeah, that's fine. I don't think I don't think LeMahieu will hit a number where we're like, ugh, I don't know about that. I don't think Bauer will hit a number where we're like, I don't know about that. And especially Springer. Like, I think now it's at this point where we're like, why is he just sitting out there? We just become so, what is the term? So desensitized to these free agents, these really good free agents just sitting out in the open for weeks and months in baseball that were just like, it's kind of crazy that he's just available. And no one's just been like, yeah, let's go sign this awesome outfielder to be awesome for our team as we try and contend for a World Series. Like, if you can do that for $125 million, you go get George Springer. Like, go do that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm completely in agreement. I think, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. We have become kind of desensitized to it because this is now, I know last winter was a little different, but, you know, 3 out of the last 4 winters now, we've seen teams just wait and wait and wait. And obviously they're just trying to get the lowest cost they can on these players by making them wait. But it's one of the many things I find so distasteful about Major League Baseball right now is that is how things operate. The teams, instead of choosing to get better, only seem to care about how can I get this at the cheapest way possible.
Yeah, and I don't think we're going the other way. The Phillies, with your old friend Dave Dombrowski, acquired Jose Alvarado in a 3-team trade. Do you have any thoughts on this?
It's the kind of move that makes sense for Philly. I mean, their bullpen was not only was their bullpen awful last year, one of the worst bullpens literally ever put together, but they also lost a lot of arms from that bullpen. And a lot of those guys won't necessarily be missed. You know, guys like David Robertson, who barely pitched, or Pat Neshek and Tommy Hunter, who never really also had a lot of injury issues. But regardless, there are a lot of innings that need to be taken there because Philly doesn't have a lot of great internal options or a lot of great remaining options. Alvarado is the kind of gamble that makes sense for them. He has great stuff when he's healthy. The problem is he hasn't really been healthy the last 2 years. I think there's some conditioning issues there too. But a guy where they can get everything on straight has closer stuff. You know, he was intermittently a closer for Tampa, as were like six other guys. Throws hard with a ton of movement. He's a regular on pitching ninja. So I think it's a good move for Philly. I like the way over at Fangraphs, Eric Longenhagen noted that for Tampa, this really seems to be more just kind of an unfortunate roster crunch situation because of the Snell trade that, you know, they didn't really get a whole lot back for Alvarado, which part of that is his stock is a little low right now. But you think they could do better with a reliever who's still cheap and who still has his kind of arsenal. So, but it's a nice move for Philly. They didn't really give up anything too notable, a lefty, Garrett Clevenger, who's going to go to the Dodgers. And obviously, since the Dodgers are picking him up, he's probably going to put up an ERA of like 2 next year with like 13 strikeouts for 9. But, you know, not a guy who really, I don't think, showed a whole lot with Philly so far. So I think it's a nice move for Philly, and it's a kind of low-risk, high-reward move that they probably should be aiming for with the bullpen, because it doesn't really seem like they're going to be spending on types of guys like Liam Hendricks or I guess Brad Hand if the Indians do decide to move him. It probably makes more sense for them to be targeting guys like Alvarado and I imagine we'll get to him later because we're going to talk about the Twins, someone like a Hansel Robles too, kind of a middle-tier reliever who has like upper-tier like capacity.
Yeah, I think it's one of many other moves that they're probably going to do. And didn't they just like sign Nefate Feliz? Like they're just, I think they're going to just be throwing, remembering some guys this offseason is going
to
be.
Yeah. And I think it's going to be interesting to see all that plays out. As same place I'm writing about the Blue Jays, I wrote about the Phillies. And I think I noted, we may have discussed it before, how weird a fit Dave Dombrowski is for a team that doesn't have a farm system with prospects he can trade away and where ownership doesn't want to spend. So they're going to have to do stuff like this.
I think the reason he did that, though, is he got, like, him and La Russa both bailing on Nashville when, like, there was a really big NY Times piece about this and what they were trying to do with the Nashville Sounds and stuff like that. I think they were just told flat out, like, expansion's not happening. And Dombrowski's like, well,
yeah,
I'm bored.
That makes sense. And then the Dombrowski would take the best job he can find, and that, realistically, that's the Phillies, because I don't think. And that's the thing. Like, that's probably one of the few teams left that would be interested in what Dombrowski has to offer at this point. Mm-hmm. Most teams, I don't think, are really terribly into his whole strategy of, well, why don't we just spend money?
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, makes it weird that the Phillies were the ones to reach out. But I think Dombrowski probably feels like, and I know this isn't a Phillies thing, but that the core of talent there is kind of win now enough that it makes sense for him to be there, as opposed to, like, the Phillies aren't a rebuild, you know, that they could be if someone different had been hired. You could have taken them in that direction, I'm sure, but this isn't a rebuild. And I'm sure Dombrowski at, you know, at his age and with everything he's done and at the stage he's in his career probably has no interest in doing that kind of thing. And the Phillies, aside from the Mets, who I doubt were ever, although honestly, Dombrowski would have made a lot of sense for the Mets. I have to imagine this was probably the best job available where the word rebuild was not part of the job description.
I don't imagine Alderson and Dombrowski would work together.
It would be interesting at least to see, because again, like, Dombrowski is the best fit for Dave Dombrowski is an owner who has no reservations about spending
money.
For sure. And it seems like Steve Cohen, Although the Mets haven't really done a whole lot this offseason yet. I imagine they are also part of those teams kind of waiting out Bauer and Springer and LeMahieu to see where they go. But Steve Cohen,
that's what I think, yeah.
Steve Cohen's spending hasn't really and you would think, too, that the advantage of having Steve Cohen as an owner is you don't have to play the waiting game. You know, you can just say to George Springer, if he wants 5-1-25, go, all right, sure, fine, whatever. You know? So it's a little interesting, a little notable that that hasn't really happened with the Mets. That their only real big expenditure so far has been James McCann on a contract that was a little high for him, but I think at the same time they probably felt like it's a little high, but it's not crazy. You know, it's $40 million. Like, we can survive that. $40 million versus $125 million, obviously. One is a much bigger number.
Jed Hoyer came out and said this week, the new president of baseball ops for the Cubs, Yu Darvish trade was not financially motivated. Case closed.
Yeah, he's a liar. He's lying. He is lying, like, and not like maliciously, but he's lying because if he comes out and says, yes, we did it for money reasons, a bunch of fans are going to go, well, then you go to hell. Like, these are the lies he has to tell. These are the lies all these GMs have to tell. That they're clumsy and obvious doesn't stop these people because, as we've learned very much and constantly over the last 4 years, the clumsiness and obviousness of a lie is just an accepted thing nowadays. Because if you have power, there's no reason for you to feel shame, I guess. I mean, Jed Hoyer is in a bad spot. He is doing what ownership is telling him to do. I'm pretty sure that if you asked him candidly, did you want to trade Yu Darvish's response would probably be, no, I don't want to trade my best pitcher for Zach Davies and some teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine that's what he wanted to do. He is just stuck at the mercy of the Ricketts, though. And being stuck at the mercy of the Ricketts means he has to come up with lies that are barely even plausible. Obviously, it was about money. Obviously, it was about money. You don't trade Yu Darvish for Zach Davies and some prospects who are far away from the majors at that if it's not about money. Nor do you go on about how this trade can't be judged until those prospects come to the majors. You're just kicking that can down the road because you know there's no justifying that trade at the moment. You know that the only reason, you know that this trade just made you worse for 2021. There's no arguing on that either. So you just move the goalposts somewhat and just say, oh, but you can't, this isn't about the 2021 Cubs. You can't really judge this trade until all these kids are up and, you know, what happens to them and blah. It's like, yeah. Well, yes. So then when do we ever get to judge the trade? You know, we have to wait till 2030 to decide if the Yu Darvish trade made sense for the Cubs. Not really, because we know what the impact is for 2021. Bad. And we know why the trade was made. Money. You know, it almost doesn't matter what the prospects do. I mean, it does, but that's not the point. The point of this trade is not the prospects. The point of this trade is the Cubs didn't want to pay Yu Darvish anymore. And so they're not gonna. And for Jed Hoyer to suggest otherwise is just kind of silly.
Yeah.
Well, not silly, but he has to do it. But again, the state
he's paid a lot of money to do that.
Yeah, he has to.
Last thing before we get into the Twins. Yasiel Puig, old friend, Braves legend Yasiel Puig, not played since 2019, but per Mark Feinson of MLB.com, there's still some interest from the Red Sox, your Red Sox, the Yankees, the Astros, the Marlins, and the Orioles. He seems very Marlins-y this offseason to me, if he gets another shot. But then again, no DH this year, maybe, in the NL. So, I don't know.
I mean, the Marlins could use a corner outfielder anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, their outfield right now is Corey Dickerson, Garrett Cooper, and... oh, geez, I'm blanking on their center fielder. Starling Marte. There we go. And... Dickerson should be a platoon player, I think. I don't know if you necessarily want to sign Puig just to have him be the weak side of a platoon. I don't think he's going to be happy doing that. But certainly, you know, should he be starting over Garrett Cooper while Cooper is just kind of a... especially because Cooper's not a good defensive outfielder. While Cooper just kind of floats around as a utility kind of infield outfield guy, like first base, maybe DH if they have it, outfield. Sure. You know, that is... that could work. And Puig makes sense for Miami too, because I believe he has a house there that he lives in part of the time during the off season. Obviously he's got the Cuba connection. You know, he would make sense kind of locally. I mean, I don't know what place makes the most sense for Yasiel Puig, because a lot of that depends on where Yasiel Puig thinks he is in his career. Like, does he want to be on a rebuilding team like the Orioles? You know, is he going to be happy with a spot on a contending team like the Yankees if it's as a reserve? Because obviously he's not going to start over Aaron Judge or Aaron Hicks, or he shouldn't start over Clint Frazier at this point. You know, I don't think he really makes any sense for the Yankees. They have too many bats at this point. But regardless, like, that's kind of – I can't really see a team giving him a dedicated starting spot unless it is a rebuilding team like Baltimore or Miami. And then, of course, the question becomes, do you want to play on a losing team in 2021 with the outside chance that you get traded at the deadline to a contending team that is probably going to use you as a platoon bat, you know? Or unless a team has an injury and needs to fill a spot. Because the other thing is we don't know what Yasiel Puig looks like. You know, we haven't, like you said, we haven't seen him play what's going to be going on a full 2 years now. He missed last year, obviously, because one, nobody wanted to sign him, and two, then he got COVID. He had a deal with the Braves that fell through. I really would have liked to have seen where that went. And Puig in 2019 was fine. You know, he's been just kind of fine for the last few years. He was a league average hitter in both Cincinnati and Cleveland, a little better than league average in Cleveland, a little worse in Cincinnati. He was great in 2017 and 2018 offensively, or at least, you know, very good. Well, who knows what we're going to get at this point? I think he more likely than not ends up with a team that, like Miami, that can actually promise him playing time and give him a chance to reestablish his value on like a one-year pillow contract, try again next winter, you know, show people like, hey, I'm still here. I'm still productive. I'm a good guy. Like, you know, give me a chance. Because he's still only going to be, what, 20? If he plays like a one-year deal in Miami, let's say, he comes out of that, he won't turn 31 until next December. So there's still room for him to sign maybe like a solid three-year deal after that. But I think that's more likely than him ending up on a real contender where they just – I don't think any contender wants to take on the chance of Puig coming there and being a headache and not producing and then having to get rid of him. I think more likely not as a place like Miami or Baltimore. And I think of the teams mentioned, Miami, again, geographically, in terms of what they need, and the fact that they're an up-and-coming team, too. Like, Baltimore is just a mess, you know? They're a construction site. Miami, you can at least see, like, you saw last year, Miami has real upside. And, you know, if you're Puig, why not take a one-year chance in a city you already like, close to your family as you can get, you know, with a team that's fun, with a fan base and a press corps that isn't going to bother you, you know? I don't really feel like Yasiel Puig is a good match with the New York media or the Boston media, God forbid. But in Miami, who cares? He can just hang out and chill and put up a good season. And if he has a good season, maybe he goes to a contender. And if he doesn't have a good season, well, then you figure it out from there.
I'll have to consult with Jeff Schultz before I make up my mind as to where Yasiel Puig should end up. The Minnesota Twins, John. Just this fan base, been tortured a lot. Going through it. And the Twins are good, and we're not seeing the fruits of what they've been doing with their new front office that's done a really good job rebuilding this franchise and getting them back to the top spot in the AL Central for several years now. Rocco Baldelli has been a great hire as a manager by all accounts. Seems like a good dude. But they just can't get over this playoff win hump. They just can't. And they're good. It's weird that Nelson Cruz, at almost 40 years old, led the team in WRC Plus this year. He might not be back. We'll get into that in a second. But for you, are they still the class of the AL Central, and will they be the class for the next 3 to 5 years?
It depends. I think Chicago is probably right there with them at this point, especially after picking up Lance Lynn. I think what would keep Minnesota at the top of the division is at least for one, they got to bring back Cruz. Because you look at that lineup, it's fine. It's a good lineup. It's a top 10 lineup, or they're probably going to finish top 10 in the league in runs scored and just general offense. But they're missing a big bat, and that big bat is Nelson Cruz, mostly because by non-tendering Eddie Rosario, which that's another, again, current baseball, not the most fun, they opened up a spot in the outfield where, I mean, if they had kept Eddie Rosario, then the problem with Nelson Cruz is easily solved. You just plug in Alex Kirilloff. Well, now Alex Kirilloff either has to play the outfield or DH. And if he's DHing, well, your left fielder is Jake Cave, Lamonte Wade Jr., Brent Rooker. These are not good options for a contending team. Like, especially because the Twins are in that point where this is very much a win-now team. You look at their roster. Obviously, there's some good young players on that roster in Luis Arraez and Kirilloff and the catcher. They have Ryan Jeffers. And, you know, they have good prospects down in their system like Royce Lewis and Gilberto Celestino and a few other guys. But this is a team with Kenta Maeda and Josh Donaldson and a few other guys who are all kind of not only nearing 30, but nearing kind of the end of team control. They got to move now. And not only they got to move now, but they're in a position to win now, especially because their only real competition in the Central is the White Sox. Assuming the Indians trade Francisco Lindor, the Indians will still be a bad team. I don't think they're going to be a good team either, though. I think the Indians, without Lindor, you probably put their ceiling at, 500, somewhere around there. They're not going to be real contenders for the division. I don't think they're even real contenders for the division now.
I also don't think they want to.
No, that's a whole other issue, right, that we can get to maybe next week, or I'm not sure. But I think, and especially in a division like the Central, where every win, you know, every extra win matters that much more. Because, and this is the thing with tying into the whole Twins playoff thing. If you're the Twins, and assuming that there is some kind of wild card game next year or another best of five first round series, or best of three? It was best of three, right?
Yes.
Yeah, best of three. Don't you want to avoid that as much as possible? Like, either by avoiding the wild card game by winning the division, or by winning the division and having a higher seed so you end up playing a weaker team, which I know didn't really help them with the Astros last year, but so it goes sometimes. And some of that playoff stuff is just fluke shit. You know, it's just, there's no earthly reason why the Twins haven't won a playoff game since like 2003. You know, that's just an incredible streak of bad luck. But at the same time, some of those have just been because they've been stuck in a wild card game where they have to win or go home. And the best way to avoid that is winning the division. And the best way to win the division is getting good players. And the best way to get good players is just giving them money. And Nelson Cruz is right there. And he's not going to be asking. Nelson Cruz is 40 years old. He's not going to be asking for a 3-year deal at this point. He can probably go year to year at this point and be happy. He's made millions and millions of dollars over his career. I don't really think Nelson Cruz at this point cares terribly much about the money. He probably cares more about, I want to win a World Series. You know, I want to be on a playoff team. The Twins are a playoff team. The Twins are a legit World Series contender. Maybe that second tier World Series contender, but a legit contender nonetheless. You know, so to me, I think that's what the Twins would need to do to stay atop the AL Central. Second part of that is they could really use some rotation depth, which I know we'll get into a little later. And third, they could use some bullpen depth too. They lost a lot of relievers in free agency, most notably Trevor May and Sergio Romo, who were both pretty good for them last year, but also Matt Whistler, Tyler Clippard. You know, they need to add some bullpen arms. They already signed Hansel Robles. They could stand to do better than Hansel Robles. You know, again, I don't know if they'd be in the market for a guy like Liam Hendricks if they consider someone like that too expensive. But, you know, there's still plenty of useful relievers out there that I think that Minnesota should be aiming to. Their moves they should be making, because this roster as it currently stands is fine. You know, it's probably a 90-win team probably. But with the White Sox right there with them, they need to scrounge up every possible win they can. Because otherwise, you know, they're looking at a wild card game, or they're looking at being a 7 or 7 seed or a 6 seed up against, say, you know, the Yankees or the A's, and that's not really a fun place to be. Although an A's Twins playoff series is really just a movable object versus a stoppable force. That's who is going to choke that worse in an Oakland Minnesota playoff series?
I have no idea. I would guess the Twins.
I know, right? It's crazy.
I would guess the Twins, which is just sad. Is there any, like, what if you had to explain to a Twins fan? You meet up with a Twins fan at a Brooklyn bar, John, once this is all over, and they're like, "Oh, what do you do?" And you're like, "Well,
I live in Manhattan, right?"
No, I'm you're in Brooklyn. If you're a sports writer in New York, you live in Brooklyn. Sorry. And you're in a bar in Brooklyn, in Bushwick, as the kids love to go to. And you're talking to a twin. You find out that there's a Twins fan sitting next to you. He's really sad, really somber going into the next year. He's like, I just want a playoff win. I don't understand why we can't do this. Why does God hate us? And although you want to say, well, look at the Browns. God clearly hates the Browns more than your team. And then he asks what you do. And you're like, well, I write about baseball. And he's like, okay, you know more than me. Explain to me like I'm five why we're struggling so much to just win one playoff game. Is there one biggest reason of all as to why we cannot win a fucking playoff game? What is your answer?
No, it's just bad luck. It's an incredible run of bad luck, but it's just bad luck. There's no good reason. I'm sure if you watched, here's the thing. There is a reason they lost every one of those games specific to those games. You know, they didn't score enough runs. Well, obviously they didn't score enough runs. A pitcher performed poorly, a bad managerial decision, a bad fielding mistake, whatever. Is there some overarching reason why for two decades the Minnesota Twins have just been so consistently one and done in the playoffs? No. Again, part of the issue they've run into is the same issue that the Pirates ran into, that the A's have run into, that a few other of the kind of non-division winners run into, and that's the wild card game is just inherently unfair. Your playoffs could be done after one game. You might win, like, I mean, the avatar of that will always be those Pirates teams from 2015 and, or 2014 and 2015 that had to face in a row Madison Bumgarner and Jake Arrieta to advance the next round of the playoffs. Like, that just sucks. You know, that's just bad luck. And that's why, again, I just harp on the fact that it's like, if you want to give yourself a better position to actually move on to the next round of the playoffs, or at least win a damn game, win your division. So you don't have to worry about the wild card, you know, and expanded playoff format would screw that up a little, but until that exists, I'm just going to add, you know, regardless, the point still stands. Do everything you can to win your division because that puts you in better position for the playoffs, you know, because there is no real reason why the Twins haven't won a playoff game in like 17 years or whatever it is. It's just, that's the luck of the draw, you know? There's nothing connecting the 2020 Twins to the, let's say, 2009 Twins, who got swept by the Yankees. You know, it's not like it's the same team just failing over and over again. It's just bad luck. But, you know, you can mitigate some of that bad luck by doing stuff like winning your division or making your team the best it possibly can be, so that when the playoffs roll around, you're not being forced to start dudes like Randy Dobnak in really important games.
Well, that naturally leads us to Nelson Cruz and his production last year. If he's not back, who replaces Nelson Cruz's production in Minnesota?
That's the problem. Well, because the thing is, like, the best option internally, like I noted, is Alex Kirilloff. But again, because they non-tendered Eddie Rosario, then you know, what are you playing Kirilloff at DH or are you playing him in the outfield? And if you're playing him at DH, okay, well, what are you doing in left field? Because your internal options there are Jake Cave and guys who are worse than Jake Cave, which is already a pretty low bar. You know, are you going to sign another outfielder? You know, would the Twins, instead of bringing back Nelson Cruz, opt for a cheaper alternative and say Kyle Schwarber as a guy who can kind of rotate in the outfield and DH? I don't know if that's, I mean, I just think like the best course of action, I'm a broken record on this, just sign the best player, especially when it is someone like Cruz, who again is not going to be asking for a long-term deal or probably anything more than like $15 to $20 million, which the Twins can afford because that payroll doesn't, again, another team that doesn't have a whole lot of payroll concerns or a whole lot of long-term contracts they have to worry about, you know, depending on what extensions, if any, they want to hand out to the likes of, you know, say Jose Berríos or to, you know, Luis Arraez or Miguel Sano or anyone else. There's not a whole lot of money tied up to anyone that, you know, where you can't just say, oh, okay, well then, yeah, no, we can't afford Nelson Cruz. Yes, you can. You don't have to get the cheaper, more cost-effective alternative to Nelson Cruz. Just go get Nelson Cruz. He makes the most sense for you, for your team. Like, and maybe some of this is Cruz and his agent are waiting to see if the NL does get the DH, so so that they can expand the market of suitors and get a better offer. And maybe that's kind of been, you know, maybe the Twins have an offer out and Cruz has just told them, I want to wait and see. But the only big money they have on their books right now is Josh Donaldson, and that's really it. You know, Maeda is signed to a very, very cheap deal. Max Kepler signed a very cheap extension. Miguel Sano is only making about $10 million a year. Like, this is a team that can very easily afford Nelson Cruz, even if he wants $25 million a year. If that's all it costs to get his bat in the lineup, you're fine. Do it. Like, I don't see the reason to hold off.
I like it. You mentioned Maeda. How good do you think he's actually going to be? Is he a future AL MVP?
Not an MVP, but I think he's certainly a legitimate top flight pitcher. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Like, you look at what he did last year, and you know, it's not a fluke. Like, the dude has always been good. He just never really got a chance to be consistently good in LA because they just kept flipping in between the rotation and the bullpen as needed. But, you know, he's got great strikeout numbers. He's got great control. You know, he doesn't allow too many hits. He's great at avoiding hard contact. Like, you look at his peripherals, all of them suggested his 2.70 ERA was pretty legit. Like, he's definitely got the stuff to be, you know, a number one starter for the Twins. The only question you have is, you know, age, because he's 32, and injury history, because he hasn't been the most durable guy in the past. But, you know, if those things hold up, and I mean, number one, that's an issue for every pitcher. But if those things hold up, I don't see any reason why he's not a number one type and a you know, top 25 pitcher in the American League, at least.
Yeah. Michael Pineda, he had a 2.2 FIP last year. Is that legit? Does he keep it going next year?
It's hard to say because Pineda is another one of those guys where it's like injuries are always the big problem, and he just doesn't have great stuff anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't really get strikeouts as much anymore. He's not a very efficient pitcher.
Not using the goo anymore.
Not using whatever it is he's been using. He's a perfectly fine mid-rotation guy. I think, the thing you worry about is, can he stay healthy and how much efficiency can he give you as a starter?
Do they need at least one more top-line starter?
They need at least one more starter, period, mm-hmm. Unless they feel really comfortable with Randy Dobnak and Devin Smeltzer, and I would not. Again, especially considering that Maeda and Pineda have had durability issues and the Berríos has kind of been up and down. I mean, they would have made a lot of sense for Darvish. I don't know if they're in the running for Bauer. I imagine he's probably too rich for their blood. But I think they could use another starter for sure. Like, I mean, maybe it's bringing back Jake Odorizzi, who was pretty good for them in 2019. Wasn't good for them last year, although he was injured. But they definitely need at least one more arm, I feel like, especially because they don't have a lot of internal depth there in terms of guys who can help right now.
I agree. Speaking of, and this is a good way to put a bow on the Twins, is the farm system. Is there help on the way? Is there any particular prospect that Twins fans should be really excited about that you're personally excited about?
Royce Lewis is the best prospect in their system, but I doubt he gets up until 2022 at the earliest. I mean, his highest level played is Double A, and he got there in 2019, and I don't think played all that much there. So I imagine the Twins are going to want to give him at least another year of development, considering he missed out on, as every minor leaguer did, missed out on a year of development in 2020. Beyond that, a lot of these guys are, I mean, Jeffers and Kirilloff obviously are already up and have already played, so I don't know if they really count as prospects necessarily. I mean, they're already there. I guess in terms of guys who are still to come, that's a tough one. Trevor Larnach could be part of that outfield solution maybe at some point in 2021, depending how he handles AAA, if there is a AAA season.
Mm-hmm.
He's their top outfield prospect along with Kirilloff. I think the bigger issue, like I noted for the Twins, is that pitching-wise, they don't really have anyone that close aside from Joan Duran. Everyone else in their system is kind of far away. They have a lot of like good younger players, but a lot of those guys are pretty far away. So, I mean, I think Larnach is probably your best bet to be internal help. But yeah, other than that, I'm kind of struggling to see, and maybe Duran, but that would probably be, I think, more in relief than anything else.
All right, John, Do you have anything else you would like to add about the Twins or any other baseball thoughts before we wrap up here today?
No, just again, I think like this is a team that needs that, like the Blue Jays is a team different. They're in a little bit of a different part of the contention cycle than Toronto, but still in that same place of, you know, spend and take advantage of the fact that this team is ready to win now and that the moves you make to win now are not going to hurt you going forward, especially if you're just targeting free agency. So I don't think the Twins are a team that's really going to be all that active in trades anyways. They don't have like the young prospects and players to move for like established stars. But I mean, shit, we just saw what Darvish cost, which was basically nothing. Like, you know, I'm not saying that the Twins need to make a Blake Snell type move. They don't have the prospects for that. But targeting someone like a Darvish from a team like the Cubs that is in a money crunch right now and is trying to shed some payroll, take advantage of that. You've got the space to do it. This is the time to do it because Chicago is right there on their tail. And, you know, they should not be taking a step back in 2021. There's, it makes no sense for this team to do that.
Yeah. John Taylor, always a pleasure, my friend. I appreciate it. I'll be back next week. Who are we doing next week? Which AL Central team is next in the docket?
I mentioned the Indians. Let's go to the Indians and get okay. Sad. Let's be sad. Let's be sad about the Cleveland baseball team.
The Cleveland Spiders. Let's do it.
The Cleveland Naps.
The Cleveland Naps. I'm okay with that too. Very pro Naps. John, thank you as always, my friend, and we will talk next week.
Sounds good.
All right, we're back on the Chase Thomas podcast, and I'm now joined by old friend Brian Phillips, Hartsfield, Jackson, just super fan over here of Pat's Pulpit. Brian, good afternoon. How are you?
Good, man. How's it going?
It's good. Have you been able to go through my old hometown airport recently?
No, we have been locked down here.
I've heard about
responsibly
this.
Responsibly locked down. Have you heard? Yeah, you've heard about this over the last, you know, like 9 months or so. Trying to stay out of the airports, if at all possible.
I understand. The Patriot season is over, but I wanted to ask you: are you sure that you don't want to watch any more Cam Newton at quarterback for the New England Patriots this season? Are you sure you're done?
Am I sure I'm done? I don't want to be done. So like that's been my revelation this year has been understanding why people enjoy watching Cam Newton, and I kind of caught the bug. Just by going back and watching and ignoring all the stupid game day like in the moment reactions to bad throws, like going back and actually taking a look at what's going on with this offense, I became a Cam. What some would qualify me as a Cam Newton stan now. So, which I, you know, whatever. But I don't know. I would like to have him. I'd love to have him back as the bridge guy to whoever they eventually go to in the future. But who knows if it's going to happen? Adam Schefter doesn't seem to think so. But I would be all on board with it.
So, as a Cam guy, in your estimation, what really happened with Cam Newton and the New England Patriots offense in 2020?
Okay, well, there's a lot there. The majority of the problem was they were bad. Which, I mean, it's tough to get more in-depth analysis than that. I understand. They had the worst collection of offensive skill personnel in the league. And it really wasn't very close. And, a lot of the season has been spent saying, well, they're not throwing a lot because of the quarterback, and my take on it has been, they aren't throwing a lot because they're not going to formulate a game plan around the worst skill position group in the league. You can't do it, especially with the way they can run the football and the things they wanted to do, utilizing Cam's legs and things like that. But it was bad. And, you know, Jakobi Meyers is the only guy all year long who could be somewhat of a consistent threat to the interior of defenses, but he's got no outside presence. There's no bailout guy in this offense whatsoever. Everything has to be absolutely perfect. And the margin for error was zero, and Cam had to be absolutely flawless with every play for them to be able to move the football effectively. And yeah, it's just impossible to ask something like that of your quarterback who joined the team late in the year during an unprecedented pandemic and having to pick up the system and following in the footsteps of, you know, what some would say the greatest quarterback of all time, and huge, huge roster problems. And it's been quite a year. And I'd say with all that context taken into account, Cam Newton was actually hashtag good. But yeah, a lot of people would have disagreed with me.
Interesting. A bigger miss for the Patriots in the last 3 years, N'Keal Harry or Sonny Michel?
Sonny Michel's so weird because the last 3 or 4 weeks since he came off of IR, it's actually, he looks like Georgia Sonny Michel.
Mm.
I know it sounds blasphemous, but we're seeing burst and passing game production and like everything we wanted out of Sony, we're seeing right now, which is totally weird. But it's N'Keal Harry. It's bad. You can't take a receiver in the first round, especially with these last two receiver classes, and miss with all of the talent that has been out there. I mean, yeah, year one, you have the hammy tweak or whatever it was in the preseason, and gets off to a slow start, but it's not good when you're expecting him to take a huge step forward this year, and you got really not much production at all from him. And there's effort issues occasionally in his film. There's just all kinds of gross stuff. He's got, towards the end of the year, they did a little contested catch stuff with him, but a majority of it was just, and he's never on the same page with his quarterback, and he's not getting separation. He's got to win jump balls, 50-50 balls. That's the only way you can really get him going in the offense, it seems. And that's not very fun.
Yeah. I still will never really understand like why the Steelers can be so good at identifying wide receiver talent. The Falcons can be so good, and then Belichick can just be so bad at one thing. It's very strange.
It absolutely blows my mind. Unless it's an undrafted receiver who used to play quarterback in college, they're not developing.
Yeah,
it's wild.
It's very strange. When you hear that Belichick looked at this season all along, and Nick Caserio and this group, that like this was all about clearing up the cap, that 2020 was a stopgap year, that they were going to get their finances in order to replenish the roster next year. They knew this year the roster would be limited, and they were just trying to tread water for a year. Do you buy that, and that they didn't actually have high expectations going into the year, and that this year really was all about clearing up the cap, and that they are going to really be aggressive in the next 2 years, getting this roster back in the group of the Chiefs and the Steelers and other teams like that?
I buy that it was a hindrance to building the roster this year. Going into the offseason, they had no money, like Bill said, and it's weird because we've never had that kind of insight from Bill mid-season into what was actually going on in the process. But they didn't really get their cap space that they have now until the opt-outs, you know, until Hightower and Chung and Bolden and all these guys started opting out, and they had no money. They had nothing. After re-signing Devin McCourty this offseason, they were down. I don't have my cap log pulled up where I keep track every week of, you know, where they're at, but it wasn't good, and that was with Tom Brady leaving, and you were sitting there all, you know, before the offseason started, thinking, you know, how the hell are they going to put together, you know, some kind of, you know, create the space to get some kind of offer, like competitive offer to Tom. And then we hear that the Joe Tooney franchise tag is applied, and he ends up playing on it. So you've got a guard taking up $14 million of your cap, and it just wasn't wasn't great. And they had a ton of dead money from Tom's deals and the restructures and the Antonio Brown grievances that hadn't hit the cap yet. I believe they'll hit next year, all kinds of fun stuff. But yeah, I mean, they certainly have a ton of work to do now. I mean, they've got the flexibility to do it, but you don't have much going on roster wise to build around. It's specifically, obviously, at quarterback.
What do you think ultimately happens at quarterback? How do you think the quarterback room changes this offseason? Do they look at a quarterback in the first round? Do they look at a quarterback like a Kyle Trask or Mac Jones in the second, third? What do you think? Or do they go after a Carson Wentz or something like that? What do you think ultimately will be the strategy from Belichick and company this offseason?
Oh, man, that's I mean, worst case scenario, but one that I think is like super likely would be they take another day two guy, a Mac Jones, somebody like that, and have them compete with Jared Stidham, and I cry the entire season.
Mm.
That's probably, and then you have to imagine they bring in some kind of veteran. I don't know what like tier they want to probably look into, you know, as far as the free agents that are on the market. But like, you've got guys like Jacoby Brissett who will be on the market. You know, obviously he's a, like, you know, they drafted him and then traded him for Phil Dorsett. And then you've got other guys that are going to be on the market, like Andy Dalton and things like that. I think eventually they'll bring somebody in to have just a lovely camp battle between two day two quarterbacks. Well, I'm sorry, Jared Stidham, the day three quarterback. A day two, a day three quarterback, you know, quarterback battle, and throw in a veteran there for some sparks. And that's going to be what they go with, because you're not, you know, unless you're in that top five draft picks this year, you're not going to get the quarterback of the future that you really want. Unless they really, really like, you know, the Mac Joneses, Kyle Trasks of the world, which, you know, wouldn't be my favorite, but hey, who knows?
Interesting. One of the funny things about Damian Harris this season, when I was watching him a little bit and people getting excited, like, who's the Patriots found another one when he had that 2 week stretch. And I was like, he was a five star and the number one running back in that Alabama class years ago. Now, it didn't pan out for a variety of reasons at Bama, but, Harris is an extremely talented guy. And if Sonny Michel is getting back on track more to what he was down the stretch, like you said, Harris and Michel is a really, really good SEC strong dynamic for the Pats going into next year, right? Especially with the offensive line getting healthy and continuing to improve on that front. Is that fair?
It's, well, you'd think, but like, then you kind of have like, you have duplicitous guy, like they're the same guy.
They really,
right?
Are,
like,
yeah.
They're the same player, specifically with the role in the offense. Damian Harris runs really hard. I love what I saw from him. He looks great, sure. But like, when you're running behind, you know, for a good majority of the year this year, they had Joe Tooney, David Andrews, and Shaq Mason on the interior. You know, they make life really easy for running backs. And next year, Joe Tooney's a free agent. You sure as hell don't want to go back-to-back years paying a left guard on the franchise tag. That's not a good way to do business, because it's, you know, his tag value is going to be 120% of this year's salary. So whatever 14 million times 1.2 is his franchise tag value. So you have to assume he's going to be on the market. He's going to get the bag. And David Andrews is a free agent. So it's you drafted Mike Onwenu, who is, you know, the big draft pick in the sixth round this year, who can play guard and tackle, and he's been a nice find. But like, you're now in jeopardy of really, you've broken up that interior trio. So things are kind of crazy all over the place, you know, for New England right now. Like, going into this, there are a million questions that have to be answered, and we're not going to have like any answers until April. It sucks.
Man, this is way more depressing than I was so excited to be hard on you about the Patriots' downfall this year. And I don't know, man. Like, there's not a lot of optimism out of you, Brian. Like, I'm a little concerned.
My optimism is, like, maybe they bring Cam back, and the guy who squeezed 7 wins out of this roster, you know, QB wins, you know, hashtag QB wins, of course. you know, you squeeze 7 wins out of this roster with Cam Newton taking a beating and having just absolutely no support, no help at all. If you got him some help, you've got a chance to move the football. You get some guys coming back. Dante Hightower should be back. Who knows? With the opt-outs and everything, they have a young core of defenders that they've drafted that they like. So like, there's a chance to build on the 7-9, but you know, you have to fill in a lot of holes, and you know, there's until you fix the quarterback spot, which is I don't understand why they're not more proactive in being like, hey, we want Cam here, and unless it's from Cam being like, hey, I want out of here, which I wouldn't blame him because he's gotten a pretty bad rap here, and they, you know, he was thrown into the fire and given like an impossible task, but they still squeezed 7 wins out of it, so. I don't know. I'm trying not to be too down, but like I knew going into last season when we talked, I had a 6-10 mark on them, and then they signed Cam, and I thought that he brought their ceiling up to 8-8, and they ended up 7-9. So, yeah, I guess we'll see.
We shall see. Did the defense regress this year in your estimation?
Massively, like crazy. And I mean, it had to, right? We saw it starting last year, creating turnovers at like a ridiculously historic pace, and towards the end of the season, obviously playing some better offenses, and it's, you know, you saw that regression. But like, you know, you take away a Dante Hightower from this defense, and it's such a crucial position he plays. But then you also take away a Kyle Van Noy and a Landon Roberts and, you know, Danny Shelton, who was really good on early downs for them last year, and it was a struggle for them to stop the run this year, which typically I don't care about, but when it was happening in the way it was happening, where they literally couldn't, you know, they weren't bends don't break. It was just they just got crushed all the way down the field with the run at times this year. And it showed in their defensive rankings. I think they were, I don't know, depending on what metric you use, but they were, you know, a bottom third defense this year in most, if not all metrics this year. So it was to be expected. They went super young. And again, with all these opt-outs and stuff, but they had a lot of young guys trying to, you know, play a lot of snaps in positions. Like Patrick Chung's position being filled by rookie Kyle Duggar, who, you know, played last year at Lenoir Rhyne. So that was a little bit of a transition for him. We had a lot of those kind of situations going on the defense this year, and, you know, it showed.
Off-season targets, who are you looking at for the Pats? Who do you like? Who are some under-the-radar and very much on-the-radar guys that you would like to see the Pats go after and who are realistic for them?
All the wide receivers, like everybody.
I think you need to give N'Keal Harry another year.
Like, N'Keal Harry is going to be a very solid wide receiver for. You know, like he, like, okay, cool. It's, you know, we're in the red zone. Let's go with the red zone package. N'Keal, get on in there. You know, get in the slot, or you know, that's where you want N'Keal Harry. Obviously, you know, you want a Corey Davis, you want an Allen Robinson, Chris Godwin probably won't hit the market, but like, you know, shell out the money for a wide receiver one if you can. They so rarely hit the open market that it's like you just have to. Or a Hunter Henry, which I wouldn't be a huge fan of, but whatever. Just go get somebody. Anybody, please. Just go get somebody. Under the radar guys, I was watching, because I'm kind of a sicko, I'm a Michigan fan, I was watching Chris Wormley, he's buried on the Steelers depth chart, and he plays like three-tech interior defensive line, kind of early down defensive end. He filled in for Cam Hayward, who sat on Sunday in Cleveland. He was drafted in the third round by Baltimore a few years ago, and then traded this offseason to Pittsburgh, and he's been a guy I've wanted on the early down package for the Patriots. I think he fits. He's going to be a unrestricted free agent, and he should come pretty cheap. So that would be a cool under the radar guy if they brought my guy Chris Wormley in. But yeah, go get some damn pass catchers. I mean, my God, go just get somebody. That's my one hope.
To wrap up here, Brian, when you look at 2021, you look at who you think might be under center, who they might target, wide receiver, maybe the defense takes a step back in the right direction. Michelle's healthy. Do you think that it's a quick fix and they're back in the playoffs and they're back winning the AFC East year over year? Or are we really going through a rebuild and that this might take some time and or it just might not get better and we're heading towards the end of the Patriots being awesome all the time?
I don't think the Patriots are going to be awesome all the time for a while. I think the only avenue they have to becoming over the next 2 years, let's call it, to being a wild card team and contending with Buffalo in the division over the next 2 years is to keep Cam Newton and put pieces around him, and then move on from there. If they don't do that and they go and they start all over again at quarterback, you're just going to see you're not having any kind of expectation to contend with Buffalo on any level is irresponsible, right? Like, Buffalo's nasty now. They're going to be a juggernaut for a little while here. And, you know, you're going to maybe be able to squeeze into a wild card spot if you have some kind of competency at quarterback, but without that and having to start over and everything, it could be a long road back to some kind of relevancy.
There you go. Brian, what can we check out from you this week at Pat's Pulpit?
I'm going to be getting some film stuff out on the Pat's Pulpit Twitter handle, at Pat's Pulpit. Going to be looking at some free agent targets. I'm just starting to do that. The under-the-radar stuff, the Chris Wormley stuff. Most of them guys that, you know, guys I've had takes on in the past that are still doing well. And, you know, that way I can confirm my priors and show everybody how smart I am.
There you go. All right, Brian. Well, good luck with that. And keep up the great work, my friend. Thanks for making the time today. I greatly appreciate it. We'll have to check in again next year when the Patriots miss the playoffs for two straight years. It's a beautiful thing. A beautiful thing.
Oof. Wouldn't that be something to start the decade?
Yeah, I'm not opposed to it. Brian, thank you. As always, good sir. And I will talk to you soon.
Okay, appreciate it, man.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
For the ones standing guard, for the eagle-eyed, for the knights in shining armor, and for all those who support them, we are Grainger, your experienced safety partner, offering supplies and solutions for every industry, committed to helping keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call clickgrainger.com/safety or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.